The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And one of my favorites, I can't believe it has been since 2018, the wine director for Liberty Entertainment Group. It is Jules Garten. Jules, thanks so much for doing this again. I appreciate.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
A delicious cup of coffee. We were talking before, coffee is a big thing for you. Coffee is where I'm the most basic. Like, I am Nescafe and a kettle. You're allowed to openly judge me for that.
No, I would never judge someone, but I am fussy as hell. Yeah. For my coffee.
I have all these questions, and I sent you a bunch, but you got married back a while back with the Andrew, owner of Oxley.
Yeah, like 2 months, 2 months, 3 months ago. I don't know.
Yeah, January.
Is this year evaporating, or is it just me?
It's April. It's early April.
Crazy.
So in January.
Yeah. But
what I'm curious about here, you got married to someone, obviously, who is also involved in the world of wine. Shout out to Oxley. I love that place.
Yeah, ish.
Ish. Oh.
Well, he's the world of food. I don't want to steal that thunder from him.
Yeah.
He's the world of food, which is good. I'm the world of wine. So like, it's a very, we have some great dinner parties.
Yes.
Put it that way. But he's super enthusiastic about wine, which is great. We have, you know, we have the passion for the same kind of style of wine and whatnot. So the other night we were out for dinner and he's just like, yeah, I'm really glad I married you. This wine is delicious. I think I bring a bit more than that, but.
But if you bring that, that's not bad.
Yeah,
as well.
Exactly.
I was going to ask you, what was the the wine like? But it was a destination wedding, so maybe you didn't
it
get
to control
about
it. Wasn't about the wine. Yeah, no, yeah. It was a rum punch wedding.
Okay.
Kind of.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect.
We had some champagne, which was great. We actually had a small beach ceremony at the Four Seasons to make mom happy, mm-hmm. You know, class it up a bit.
Yes.
So we had a little bit, you know, we had some champagne there, and then we had a little after party at a local beach bar with some live reggae music, which was great.
Yeah.
Had a little champagne there, but yeah. It really was
champagne and rum punch.
Yeah,
perfect.
It was kind of not about wine that day.
We're going to get into a ton of stuff about the news project Blue Bovine Steak and Sushi House down by Union Station. I'm going to get there, but now I have many more questions here.
Okay.
What was Andrew, and I love this because this is, as you know, and people listen to know, I'm a massive fan of the Oxley. What was Andrew's wine knowledge and appreciation on your first date versus when you got married? And I guess really the question is, how much impact have you had on someone who's involved in the culinary world, but even elevating their sort of wine appreciation?
Good question.
By the way, hold on. Is that actually a good question? Or did you say good question because you're stalling to come up for the answer?
I'm kind of stalling to come up for the answer, actually.
And here, I'm going to give you a bit of an answer. I'm going to now give you a second
well,
to think
I
about
met
it.
You at the Oxley.
Yeah, I know.
Like, that's where we kind of
yes.
met back in the day.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, I'm going to give you a second. Two things. One, first time I ever decanted white wine was a Sauvignon that you
yes.
That you were decanting.
I remember that.
Sad I remember that, but I'll forget people's birthdays. Like, my girlfriend, she was always into wine before me.
Yeah.
And she said, she's like, yeah, my appreciation and what I like and don't like. It's not like I told her what to do, but it's more just exposed to more things. And she's like, my wine knowledge appreciation is different than when we started dating 100 years ago.
It's hard because you only know like the person from when you know them and you were with them kind of like after the fact versus
yeah.
like what was going on before the fact.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, like, where Andrew's concerned, he has a good background for wine, I think, just coming through culinary or whatever. So I don't know
yeah.
if he's necessarily drinking different things than he was before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's just kind of a hard question, sir.
I just like the
that's
super
a for him question.
I like, yeah, no, maybe it is more for him. And I want to interview him at some point. Just, I actually think of you guys as a super couple. As you're bringing the wine, he's bringing the food. It's like
yeah.
Wonder Twins activate.
Yeah,
that's kind
exactly.
of what I thought of. Can you take us through every job you've had
since we met last,
since the last time we did
yeah.
the podcast, which was November 6, 2018.
Like, we have to be fair though, because there was like a solid 3 years since I saw you last that just didn't exist on the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of I don't know if I'm loyal, if it's a loyalty thing, but I don't jump around with jobs,
like, which is rare in this business.
It is. I do all my research, and so I don't really like making a commitment necessarily if I don't think it's going to be the right fit, if it's going to be the next smart career move. So I very shortly after we last met, I had an opportunity to go and work at the Four Seasons. So and that was like 17 interviews, and I was very happy where I was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like I was looking. A mutual friend in the industry knew the GM there, and you know, they were really struggling to find the right person for the role. So I started there January 2019, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So only a couple of months after we met last. And I was there for 3.5, 4 years as the wine director for the hotel. And then James Peden, who is in operations for Liberty, we, again, knew each other through the wine thing. We met, I think actually it was during COVID. We knew each other just through, you know, the circles of the industry, but he had reached out to me. I was still at the Four Seasons to go for like a drink because he wanted to pick my brain about having multiple different properties pulling wine from like the same cellar. Because during COVID, you know, all the operations kind of switched at Liberty and how they were doing things with Don Alfonso being up at the castle. And then he approached me about CAPS. So the Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers, like he was the president and he's like, hey, I need some fresh blood on the board. So we met to have a drink. And then like, while we were talking about that, he was sort of like, oh, I could get you from the Four Seasons, you know, because you're never sure if a person's going to leave where they are. So we had that conversation and he was like, oh, I'm going to need to fill the wine director role. And I was like, yeah, like I'd be very interested in that. So kind of a couple months went by, and when he was ready to pursue that position, like he came like straight to me. So it's kind of interesting. I've never really applied for a job. It's like 2012. I've just sort of had these opportunities come past and they've been, you know, the best next step. So really
only two jobs since which is rare. That's really rare in the industry, especially during COVID when there was so much upheaval, which anytime there's chaos, it means there's going to be a lot more movement. So the fact you only went to two places, that is remarkable. All right, let's take a quote from James. Here is James Peden. What really brought Don Alfonso Toronto to the next level was the addition of our new wine director, Julie Garten. She has so much experience pairing wine with food and such an elegant wine service. She is the tide that raised all the ships in terms of our wine program. I found that quote from James talking about you.
Isn't that nice, James Peden? I'll have to thank him.
Yes. Yeah. What's it like putting together like the wine cellar, the wine selection? Because just as you sort of alluded to, Don Alfonso is going to be different than Blue Bovine Steak and Sushi House. So how difficult, what is that process like?
So Don Alfonso was kind of interesting because my physical like first day with the company was the first service, the first day the doors opened.
Really?
At the Western Harbor Castle. So I think I went in and like observed an operations, one of the friends and families like observed the operation for like one shift. And then it was like, boom, right? And because it was interesting because it wasn't a brand new restaurant opening. Like it existed. And like through COVID, we were doing the more of that like pop-up, right? So the staff knew what was going on. You know, the chefs knew the menu. Everyone kind of knew everything. So it was a bit turnkey. You walk in and, you know, it's just you're in a new environment, but everything exists. James had moved the wine from the old like version of the property in and kind of put everything away. So it's like I walked into a cellar I didn't set up, wines that, you know, I'd had like a minute to kind of read about. And the list at the time, right when we opened, like it was kind of bare bones. So that was nice for me because I really got to put my mark on it. But the first service was like, it was really funny for me because you're there, you're in a section, right? It's not like you're, you know,
easing into it with a
2 week training period. It was just like, okay, go. And Justin, who was with the company for a long time, like he was the second somm and James was there as a somm. I couldn't tell you the exact number of wines we sort of had in that program on that first day when I walked in. But, you know, I just submitted the list for Wine Spectator back in February for the renewal. And like we're over 800 individual SKUs on that list. So it's a really large program. The pairing is a big thing there, right? Because we offer the signature tasty menu. We do two tiers of pairing, looking and a lot of chat about potentially like doing that ultimate tier where we can really throw some, you know, some sick wines at it.
Hold on. What in your mind, what would be the ultimate tier? And you don't have to be specific.
Oh, no. Like, but specifically, we're talking like Krug for your champagne selection.
Yep.
Chateau Yquem for your dessert selection. Okay. Back Vintage Sassicaia, like pulling out all the stops.
Right.
And we'd have to look at it and it would just be costed out based on what we were using. But it would be that ultimate opportunity to come in and just taste.
Oh, that'd be cool.
Like, these wines that aren't always accessible
and
are rare, you know, and they'd fit with the menu and whatnot, but it would really be like a bit of a a mic drop wine pairing.
You're getting the greatest hits album.
Yeah,
you're
getting, yeah, it would be really fun to do something.
There's
like
no
that,
B-side.
Right?
You're getting the greatest hits. I guess because I was wondering, like, when you just started on that first day at Don Alfonso, that it might have been intimidating. But I guess considering all the years at Oxley, all the years at Four Seasons, it probably, I mean, that first day must have been an odd experience, but it probably wasn't overwhelming.
It was a surreal experience. It was intimidating. It was different, right? Like, you always want to be at your, I always want to be at my absolute best, right? But knowledge is power. So knowing menus inside and out, knowing everything about operations inside and out makes, I think, me or you, like, mm-hmm. makes you better at what you do. It makes you confident at what you do. So I didn't have all that down, right? Like, walking on the first day, like, you're, you know, I hadn't had a chance at that point yet to taste all the dishes with the wines, right? So you're getting your knowledge from other people on why things work and whatnot. But yeah, it was definitely, you were figuring it out. Yeah. So yeah, I would say, like, that first day was definitely overwhelming and probably a little bit intimidating. I don't remember so much exactly now, but and we were so busy. Like, it was just, wasn't even like it was crazy from the get-go. Like, it was, which was great, because being in a busy restaurant's awesome.
And you had, I mean, at the very least, a lot of great people to lean on. I remember when I was there for dinner, I'm like, wait a minute, I think at least four members of the staff have been on my podcast before.
It was literally a goal of, like, James, when James brought me on, he was just like, I want Liberty to be the company that like every salmon in Toronto wants to work for. Mm-hmm. Like, and you know, even agents, sometimes it's really funny. We'll be chatting. I'll be like, oh, so-and-so. And they're like, that's where that person went. They're like, you really have, like, you guys really have, like, all the psalms, eh?
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny.
And that's a good thing for people going to any of the Liberty restaurants, is you're guaranteed.
Well, we're super fortunate. Like, I think one of the great things about the company is the value they see in what we do. Nick recognizes if we have this category of employee and, like, we invest in them, like, it's going to benefit the business.
It reminds me and I'm going to go sports for a quick second, the Los Angeles Dodgers, who spent like $1 billion in free agency when LeBron James went to the Miami Heat, and the big three when Durant went to the Golden State Warriors. Anyway,
yeah.
Anyone with sports knowledge is nodding, and they know exactly what I'm talking about. And everyone else is like, what the fuck are you talking about, Cause? But, like, that was actually my thought when I went in there. I was like, whoa, okay, there's an all-star. Like, just, it was just heavy hitters wandering around at Don Alfonso. But let's go to, because I've chatted a bunch about Don. And by the way, that bar there, I mean, if you can just go and sit at the bar.
You can.
I know.
Come on in.
I've been. It's a hell of a place. I got to poke my head in a little while ago. I was wondering if you could just take us through Blue Bovine. What do people need to know? And it's a Union Station, sort of like the east corner of Union Station.
Yeah, we're basically street level, so that's a definitely important thing to know.
Yes.
You get a lot of calls, especially if someone's coming from the underground struggling to find it. But we are kind of street level. Closest entrance is right at Front Street in Bay. Mm-hmm. We have our big metal bull out front to guide people in.
To help people.
It's great. It's a large restaurant. I think we have close to 200 seats in there between the lounge itself and the bar and the dining room.
Yeah, that place goes deep.
But it's nice, kind of, I think, with the kind of the lower kind of ceiling and the way they, like, there's a kind of this intimate vibe to it too, especially when it's kind of dark. Like, it's a large place, but it still kind of has a little bit of that kind of intimate kind of speakeasy feel to it, because it is a little kind of tucked away in itself. Big operation in the fact, like, we do lunch there, right? So it's of our kind of top high-end flagships. It's the only one we've been opening for lunch service, but it's
right,
it makes sense.
No,
right downtown.
Yeah, Don Alfonso, Blue Blood. Right. Okay.
Those guys were dinner only there, so we are 7 days a week there. We're open for lunch Monday to Friday from 11 a.m. And that's great for those, like, you know, nice business lunches, having somewhere new to go and, you know, being in the heart of downtown. Happy hour, we're doing a little happy hour menu from 3 to 5 p.m. We can come in and we have some, like, great little bites, nice wines you can do for $10 a glass, highballs, martinis. So that's kind of fun. It's a bit of a...
That's an interesting one. I want to check it out. I remember I always enjoyed before Shore Club. They did a good happy hour as well. But yeah, I'm curious, because I think that can be a great way to get people who, you know, maybe just want to poke their head in for the first time, more of a high-end restaurant, and sort of get the feel for it. I always treat a good happy hour should be like the entry level, when a famous winery has a good entry level wine. Like,
yeah.
Gugel's Cote de Rhone, I always said, all right, It's an entry-level wine, but it's made with love. And then eventually, next thing you know, you're drinking their Cote Rôti. That's sort of how I look at it.
Yeah, I like that analogy.
What are the wines? What do people get there?
So we have...
And I'm sure it rotates, so I didn't interrupt.
Yeah, we're doing a Prosecco. So we always have a Bubbles. And then we have two whites, two reds. So right now we're doing a Muscadet, the Tortigiano, which is a blend from southern, central Italy, I should say. We've got a Chianti and a Malbec. So it's not like it's just, hey, here's your one wine you're getting. Like, I think it's nice that we have a little bit of variety there.
The
wines to choose from.
What would you recommend for because also with your places, it's not just steak, but like I saw the guys working.
Yeah.
The sushi station that was.
It's like almost like two restaurants in one. We have a killer sushi program run by Chef Eugene. So you can have two totally different experiences. You could literally go in there and just do Japanese for the night, or you can go and do the more traditional steakhouse. And what a lot of people are doing is they're kind of coming in, they're doing that first round course from the sushi station, and then they're kind of following up with steak and sides. Table side, yeah.
What do you recommend for sushi? If people, and if they're at your place or if they're at home, whatever, just is there classic, what are your classic wine and sushi pairings?
I mean, so I guess it depends where you're really going to go
right.
on the sushi, right? Like, I'm kind of guilty in the fact that I eat most of the sushi I eat. It's kind of like takeout sushi.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No, but there Andrew and I were talking wrong. Like, because there's so many great restaurants in Toronto. Like, it's a thing now. Like, you look at Michelin and half the restaurants are doing, they're like Japanese, doing omakase and whatnot. So we were literally saying, we have to go out and just like, we have to go have like great sushi and see what that's all about.
You're getting the nice sushi. We'll go. You're good. A nice restaurant level sushi, not comfort level.
No. Like, yeah. If you're having the actual like nigiri or sashimi or whatnot, depending on the sushi, great sakis, right? Like we started. It's interesting. We started with kind of a concise sake program there because we just wanted to see what was going to happen, right? Like it's the first time really in the company we've kind of put it front and center on a list. So it was myself and then Christina Brown, who's the head sommelier there. So it was a bit of a tight list. I think we had maybe like eight kind of sakis when it opened, a couple we were doing by the glass. And then within like, you know, the first couple of weeks of opening, it was like, oh wow, like we were surprised how much we were selling. So then we were able to go and kind of add to it. So we have like a Desai 45, which we tasted and I loved it. It's a Nigori, so it's an unfiltered sake and it was great. It didn't come on that initial opening list because we were like, let's just see what sells, but we have that in there now. And like, to me, I love that sake. I think it's super versatile. You know, maybe if you're doing more of the classic, you know, like a Yellowtail, right? I think if you're getting into maybe eel or maybe a little bit more of those kind of savory or intense flavored dishes or pieces, like you might go a little bit different. Maybe a sake that has it's a little bit more driven by the umami quality itself. We do like sushi with the A5 Wagyu. So we have like one of those really umami driven sakis there that is intended for that. Or even when people maybe want sake with their steak.
Oh, I've never had that before.
Yeah. But even those like just in terms of wine with sushi, like, I mean, champagne friggin' goes with everything.
Yes.
So like you can never really go wrong with that. But nice aromatic whites that have like a little bit of salinity to it. You know, if you want to do like an Albarino, you get a little bit of that aromatic, you get a little bit of the salinity. Chablis work really well. Whites from Etna, the Etna Biancos, those work really nice. So there's a lot you can kind of do with wine and sake as well. So
I want to get to more big picture, but I'll just go back to the wine. Is there a big difference between the Blue Bovine and say Alfonso or Blue Blood in terms of the wine programs? Are they fairly similar? Because I mean, I would imagine we get similar clientele. I mean, the menus of those three places are different. As someone who has eaten at two of the three.
Yeah, they're similar in some respects, but then different in some respects. So Don Alfonso and then Danico. So that's we just opened that as well. Like that was a 2002-2003 September restaurant open. Italian, you know, concept, tasty menu. So those programs, like they lean heavy in Italian wine. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, all the greats from Piemonte, from Tuscany, and the tiny regions in between. But we showcase everything, right? So they're not exclusively Italian. We bring in a lot of French wines. They're a lot focused around what works with the food. So yeah, we have a great selection of Napa Cab. We're really fortunate because I go to auction a lot.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just the best way to round out the depth. So like in terms of across those kind of four top flagship properties, you know, the steakhouses, they're going to lean a little bit heavier on the full body, the Bordeaux, the cabs, right? Because people come into steakhouse, that's what they're looking for. That's what they want to drink.
Hell yeah.
The Italian restaurants, a little bit more forward in Italy. But the programs themselves, like, you know, we've invested in them, which is great. So we have larger lists. We have a lot of back vintage. One of the things we look at is, you know, building those verticals as we go, like, year to year. And the other great thing is just because of the amount of buying we're doing with these flagship properties, we get access to great wines, right? Because it's not always easy to get your hands on the wines that you want to have in your program.
How competitive do you get when you're monitoring these wine auctions? Because I got to tell you, there's been some times I've gotten so pissed off. I'm like, all right.
Probably me.
I'm not going to be going after what you're going for. Unless if you are taking all the New Zealand Pinot Noir, I'm going to be so fucking angry. Because I'm usually New Zealand and Germany. Those are the two areas, you know, that my shark is circling around. But how competitive do you get with that?
The first point is, like, because you can tie the Waddingtons to the license, it's really the only auction that we work with, like, for legality reasons.
Yeah.
I sit there. Like, that's my evening, right? Like, I sit in front of my computer for 4 hours straight going lot by lot by lot. Because you can kind of put your pre-bid in on stuff, but then you don't know if it's bid up, how it's going.
Yeah.
So I stock the auction. I map it out, right? I look at what they're estimating the lots to go for or where they're at a little bit in advance. Also, like, I have to be able to sell it. I have to be able to mark it up and I have to be able to sell it. So there's things I might really want and boom, they'll go too high. And it's like, no, I have that point where I stop. Like, it's costed in my head. I know what it's hitting the list for. I know what I have around that area. You know, if I'm going for Wernalai and I have three other vintages on the list, I know what I'm charging for them. There's a lot that kind of goes into it. Like, you have to be really skillful, but then I'll end up buying lots that weren't maybe on my, like, you know, like, first crack list because they're a steal. You're like, oh wow, like, God, no one's bid on that. Like, so you'll swipe some things that maybe you weren't thinking of getting. But yeah, I just wish there was more of them.
So you're sitting there like a 17-year-old seeing about getting tickets to a Taylor Swift concert.
Like, it goes pretty fast though, I have to say. Like, 4 hours.
Yeah,
it kind of passes because they're closing every 10 minutes. So yeah. Like, you're kind of looking ahead, and then I'm also like, okay, like, you know, so I map out all the numbers of the lots I'm looking at and map out the budget that I'm working with, because there's always a budget you're shopping with, right? It's not endless.
Question for you that this could relate with Blue Bovine, anywhere at Liberty Entertainment, or even Oxley, Four Seasons, wherever. Have you had that difficult time every now and then balancing your passion versus profit, where it's like, oh my God, I love this wine. This is a special wine from a great producer. And then the owner or someone else is like, yeah, but how are you going to sell that?
I think that is a journey that everybody goes through in my profession. And I think, yes, have I had that? Yes. But like the first maybe 3 years of running a program, right? You come and you've passed and you're all passionate and you love this and you think you know everything.
It's all white Rome.
Right?
We are only serving white Rome wine.
The world, yeah. And everyone's thinking of wine, right? And it's usually like the owner of a restaurant or someone that's sort of like, Jules, no one cares. Like, they don't care, right?
Yeah.
You care and that's great. And you're going to have that guest like Matt Cause that walks in and he wants to have a cool experience and he cares.
Yeah.
It is very business, right? Like, I don't want to put a bad, where it comes down to is recognizing the good from the bad. Okay. So maybe you have to sell a category of wine you're less enthusiastic about. Where you can have an impact on that is picking the best wines in that category.
Right.
The best wines for the guests that want to drink that.
Yeah.
So I look at it from that angle, but I'm very driven, right? And I remember saying this to one of my wine agents, we were talking about it, and I was like, listen, like, I work for Liberty. Like, my sole job, like, yes, I'm a sommelier and I got to give people experience, but like, my job is to make Liberty money, right?
Right.
Yeah, I want to support the agent, but I don't work for the agency and I don't work for the winery either. So like, there's that balance of I'm going to support the people that I think do a great job and I'm going to put the great wines in there. But at the end of the day, my soul, Liberty pays me. Like,
yes,
that is my job. I work for the company.
They need to make a profit. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, of course. I think if ever I was in a position like that, the first 6 months, I'd be horrible and I'd probably be fired. Because, you know, I would just be like, all we are serving is white Vaccarat. That's it. That's all we're getting. And then 6 months later, it's like, well, we haven't sold any wine and we've lost a lot of money and you're fired. And I'm like, I guess I should have brought in that Pinot Grigio. Like, I feel that would be me early on in that job.
Yeah. It's how you price things out as well. Like, you know, you make a lot of money on your buy the glass. Like every restaurant's going to make majority of their money on their buy the glass, right? But then offering value. I like to offer value at the top. And if someone's going to come in and drink that great bottle of wine, there should be value on that.
Right.
And there is. And one of the great things about where we work is I've ran great wine programs. It's still surprising some of the wines we get to open. You know, they don't just sit there and collect dust on a wall. They move.
Do you have a wine or two that really just you were excited, shocked to get to try? Like, oh my God, I can't believe this bottle's been opened and I'm getting a little sneaky ounce of it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the nice thing as well with the style of service that we do, right? So every bottle of wine is opened by a sommelier. Mm-hmm. We check everything. We're conditioning decanters. We have all of the tools. So back vintage, it's going in a cradle. It's being decanted over a candle. We're using the Duran like for clean cork removal. We're ensuring the wine is showing well. You know, we're checking it. Do we need to decant it? Don't we want to decant it? Like, where is that? And
you guys are the living embodiment of the CMS service.
We do. And we very much practice. Yep. That is the standards for wine service that we do across the properties. So September, I was really fortunate to get my hands on a couple bottles of Petrus at the auction.
Mm-hmm.
They're gone.
Yeah.
We've sold them. We've sold through almost all the DRC that we've had. So there was X amount in the company when I started. You know, we had the 19s come in. We're waiting for 20s now, I think, to get released. Like, we've probably sold a dozen bottles of DRC. 2 years of being with the company. So like, really, it's great. Like,
yeah.
You know, you got to have that experience with that wine.
Is there part of you that's going, no, don't open the 19. It's way too young.
Always. Yeah. You're like, we're just murdering babies here.
Yeah.
But you know,
yeah.
it still frees up the cash flow to go back to the auction and, you know, keep shopping.
Totally off topic. Your cat has got really good range in terms of jumping.
Yeah.
I did not expect it. Your cat just jumped up on top of the radiator and I was watching it going, there's no way at your size that you were going to have the ability to land that. But good job.
Yeah, no, she's agile. She's great. She goes to the top of that
too. Oh my.
And all the way up.
I know it's a bad pod by a visual thing, but that's a really high a drawer or whatever.
It's like 5 feet.
Yeah, good job. What's the difference between, let's go wine service, between a damn good restaurant, like a great restaurant versus Michelin star level?
How do you separate those two? Won the award, didn't win the award. Like,
or maybe there isn't. Like,
like great restaurant. So like, what makes wine service great in a great restaurant? I think it's investing in great glassware. Mm-hmm. It's investing in tools like great decanters, investing in staff, professionals to do it. All of that, right? Like all those little things are going to lead to having that great service.
And I bring this up because I've been to, you know, it's just some great restaurants. I don't spend money on many things beyond food and wine. And at a great restaurant, I'm like, oh, wow, you know, it's great service. I love the Somme and everything was fantastic. And then trust me, this is not meant to be a Liberty Entertainment Group infomercial. But when I've been, you know, when I was at Don Alfonso, or when I was at Blue Blood, I could feel that he was at an even higher level, which was not to take anything away from the 99.9% of the other great restaurants I've been to. But I could sort of just sense like, oh, this is at even a higher level than, you know, a really nice restaurant. And I'm always trying to figure out exactly what is the...
That makes me feel great. I'm so happy to hear that my team's doing
a great job
everywhere.
Oh, yeah. No, listen, I was out with the same group of friends, went to Blue Blood. We were talking about the other day. Like, just the service just felt like a little bit even more elevated. And I was wondering if there's any tangible difference.
I'll just talk about one of my pet peeves. So like restaurant aside, right? Maybe you're serving like a $25 main course. Maybe you're having a $75 main course, like whatever it is. One of the things is every server out there right now, like they want their 20% tip, or like, God, maybe it's 25% now. Mm-hmm. Like it's the tip nudging's crazy. Okay. If I'm going to buy this bottle of wine, whatever I'm spending, $100, $150, like I don't want to fill that glass. So like, there's just the simple little thing at any caliber of restaurant. It's fill the guest wine, fill that glass for them. Right. Like when I'm and because now I'm in an environment where like the wine is not on the table, the wine is on a Gyrodon, like we're filling every single glass. Right? You'll never come into like, you know, Blue Blood Steakhouse and see a guest fill their wine. Like it doesn't happen, right? Everything is done by the staff. It's done by the sommeliers. And that is really like it seems like a simple thing, but like to me, that should just happen across whatever restaurant you're at. Fill my water, fill my wine. Like that's kind of basic service. And I think that's really missed a lot of places.
This is going to sound odd. Have you ever seen the movie Casino? Do you remember the Martin Scorsese movie Casino?
It was a long time ago.
So the opening 20 minutes, they're doing this huge montage at the what goes on in a casino. This person's watching the dealer, and the person watching the dealer, this person's watching them, and the pit boss is watching them. And it's this whole thing about how everyone is watching someone else. That's kind of what it feels like, where it's like my glass is now empty, and then a second later, it's no longer. And it's filled up just to the right amount. It's nowhere close to the brim. It's a couple inches. But I think maybe that's it. This is another weird analogy, is that top-level wine service, it feels like I'm in the middle of the movie, the opening 20 minutes of Casino.
It's attention to detail.
Yeah.
It's all attention to detail. One of the things I love about Don Alfonso itself as a restaurant for service is it's the way the restaurant flows, right? Like, yeah. I will just walk a circle around that restaurant looking at every table, and I'll be able to look at the cutlery and know what course is coming next. I'll be able to look at the glassware and say, okay, I'm going to go to the bar because that person's waiting. Like, we pour all the by the glass table side as well. Mm-hmm. But it's literally that attention to detail. It's been able to kind of look at a table and know exactly where it's at because you know how that restaurant operates. You know what cutlery matches which dish. You can tell we use a wide range of glassware specific to different styles of wine. So I think that's also really what it boils down to.
Is it hard for you to turn it off when you're out at a restaurant?
Absolutely. Yes.
You didn't even let me get the question. How difficult is it for you if you are out somewhere and just to not to be hyper aware of everything going on around you?
So it's really funny, right? Because like Andrew and I'll go out and I give him crap all the time. I'm like, you were the worst person to go out to a restaurant with, because he'll pull the food apart. Like, one of the things that really bothers him, and it should bother everybody, is how expensive things are. When you know the difference, right? You know the difference. You know what you're being charged. You know what things cost. If I'm paying a premium, like, it needs to deliver.
Yeah.
Like, it needs to deliver. Because most of the time I could go out and, yeah, maybe dinner's okay. But like, by the time I get the bill, that's my measure of, is it a good experience? Was it a good restaurant? Okay, when the bill comes, am I like, okay, yeah, that was worth that? Or I'm like, oh my God, right? Mm-hmm. So, because it's just gotten so incredibly expensive to dine out. Even at casual restaurants, it's expensive to dine out,
yeah,
right? For me, I'm always critical of the service. Like, I'm more like looking like, why didn't that happen? Why is this like this, like missteps? But where he's really kind of more critical about the food, and because he knows the cost of everything and you know what's going on. And then you're looking around at, you know, staff in a restaurant. How many staff are we paying to have here?
Yeah. When it's the two of you guys, that could be the whole conversation for the night. But what happens when you guys are out with people that aren't in the service industry?
Entirely different, right? Yeah. You're in the conversation.
Are you biting your lip? You're just like, you know,
I always, even if it's like the two of us, right? It's more like, we had a great dinner. We went out to Don Alfonso last night for dinner. Mm-hmm. I like going to their restaurants, like, you know, every 6 months or so, like just see how the new dishes are showing, see where we're at in terms of the service level. But it's hilarious, right? Because especially when it's your own restaurant, you're looking, and Andrew's looking at me, he's like, chill out, relax, like stop watching everything, relax. And I'm like, oh, it's so hard.
Wait a minute, now I picture you now sitting at Don Alfonso like undercover boss, like you're putting on like a wig or something and not wanting anyone to see who you are.
I don't hide.
Yeah.
But it's always just, I think it's really nice to go out, right? And, you know, go out to his restaurant, go out to your own restaurants and have that experience you're giving to people, right?
So
you know what people are getting.
Unexpected wine that goes with high-end steaks or beef is like, because everyone is, and for people listening, they're gonna, you know, you always are gonna assume, and correctly so, these wines were made for it, you know, your Bordeaux's, your Napa Cabs, they were made for it. But if someone's like, I want to try something different, I was wondering about any recommendations you would give. Either you can be a specific producer or appellation or country that you think, all right, that wine there is going to go really good with that steak, and you might not know it.
Yeah, and you know what? It always comes down to the different cuts of steak. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Like, one of the great things about, like, really all the flagship properties, we use that A5 Wagyu, right? We have it available at the steakhouses. We have dishes with it at, you know, Don Alfonso and Danico. And I think everyone thinks, right? And you have that conversation when you're going to the table to do a consult. They're like, oh, well, we're having the steak, we're having the Wagyu, so we should have a big wine. And I was like, no. And that's the really neat thing with doing all of the pairings and constantly like trying food with wine. It's such a delicate meat. It needs a delicate wine. Mm-hmm. So like when we're pairing with that level of beef or like those Wagyu cuts, like I'm like Pinot Noir. I'm like in Burgundy. I'm like soft texture, smooth, nice freshness. Like I will throw a producer out there, the Envenate, the Lusas. Like that is such a versatile wine. Mm-hmm. We go through cases of it at the restaurants, but really like more of those delicate, refined, soft textured wines with a cut like that, right? Mm-hmm. And then it depends if you're in, you know, if you're doing maybe more of a New York or you're doing like a ribeye or something, you maybe want a little bit more structure to wine to help kind of break down the protein. I always love Syrah. I don't necessarily go towards those big, bold, punchy, tons of oak wines because like they will overpower everything. They'll overpower a steak.
Yeah.
But maybe it's also like partial. Like I love Syrah, but like if I'm having something a little bit fuller bodied, right, with a nice peppery note for like seasoning the beef, they still have that nice freshness to help kind of like cleanse the palate, you know, because there's a lot of marbling in those cuts. So yeah, that would be, you know, Northern Rhone Syrah would be definitely an area I would go to.
I always laugh that there are three wines that everyone who works in wine studies, sommeliers, or anyone in the industry, there's three wines that everyone in wine loves: Beaujolais, German Riesling, Northern Rhone Syrah.
Yeah.
Those are three that are going to be basically, if this was Rotten Tomatoes, it's going to be 99% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, you nailed it.
Yeah. And by the way,
I'm still having that conversation with tables when they're like, oh, like Beaujolais, right? And I was like, oh, okay, you know, yeah, move it aside.
Ooh. do you have moment, like, what are those moments like? When again, outwardly, Jules is 100% the professional that you want. But inwardly, is there one that, let's see, what bothers you more? Fear of Beaujolais or people like, oh, Riesling, that has a lot of sugar in it, doesn't it?
It's the opportunity to educate, I guess, a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's still a lot of people that think all Rieslings are sweet, right? And so like, hey, are you willing to try this, right? And I'm always like, try it. If you don't like it, we'll get you something else.
Yeah.
Right? But it's educating, right? It's explaining, you know, not all Beaujolais is Beaujolais Nouveau, right? Mm-hmm. Then you start talking about the different crews and the producers and just finding that experience for the guest, right? Like, I'm never going to tell someone they're wrong.
No.
Like, that's not what we do in this industry.
Yeah, it's not about right or wrong. It's more about, yeah.
Yeah, right? I do that all the time. Like, that was a big thing, like, years ago in my career. Like, I think it's important. Like, we live in Ontario, right? I think it's important to kind of represent what we do here. I like having Canadian wine by the glass in different categories, but there's still the stigma that we make bad wine, right? Like you hear
I fight
it
that
all
fight
the
all
time,
the time. Yeah.
Right? And it's like, I'm not gonna like get in an argument with people, but you're like, okay, you know what? Let me bring you a couple things to try. And you bring a couple glasses over and you put some tasters down, and 9 out of 10 times they pick the wine they didn't think they like.
Yeah.
And you're like, great, okay, I'm gonna pour you a glass. I'm not gonna be like, I told you so, you know, like just gonna get you a glass, great.
But that's got to be an awesome feeling, because again, to reiterate, it's never about right or wrong. It's more about just an opportunity to expose something.
Yeah, right. It's people's preference as well. I might not want to drink what you're describing, but like I have it for you, mm-hmm. right? So there's like this process of translation and being like, okay, you're describing this to me. That is this bottle of wine. Boom. And like the best satisfaction I get in a job, like in what I do, is when the table's like, oh my God, this is great. I love it. And you're like, yes, like great. I know what I'm doing. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. It's not about wins or losses. It's about making the experience better for the person there.
Everything's about elevating and enhancing a guest experience.
It's really no different than someone who's like a cinephile going, oh, no, you haven't seen this movie? Oh, no, you got to try this movie. You're going to love it. Or someone who loves a TV show. What, you never saw The Wire? Okay, you got to see you would love The Wire. And then someone goes back and goes, oh, yeah, I saw The Wire. My God, what a great show. Thanks for telling me all about it. There's a similarity to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Day in the life. What is a busy day in the life of a wine director for such an extensive company? Like, what's a busy day like for Jules?
We are a very large company.
Yes.
You know, we're just growing by the minute. So we have a lot of properties. It's really like part of what fuels me and what I do. Like there's a lot of administrative work with my position and what I do. But I still love the service aspect of it. So like if I'm busy and like, you know, maybe there's a week where it's a really admin heavy week and I don't get to do as much service, it's almost like you get kind of drained.
Right.
So at least probably almost every day I'm on a floor somewhere, supporting the team, helping with service, working with the somms that we have. So usually say my day is more like a 12 to 9 typically. Mm-hmm. I go in, you know, if I have a couple of meetings, I take care of whatever administrative stuff we have on, procurements, updates, list, all that stuff. And then a couple hours in service. And it's really like, you know, I try to pinpoint where I'm going to be every week. Like, so I get to write my own schedule, which is nice. And I kind of try to look ahead at like forecasting, cover, staffing levels to figure it out. But, you know, there's some days where it's like, okay, hey, you know, we've really picked up here. We could use the extra set of hands. All right, you're covered. You're going to be good. I'm going to pivot. I'm going to go over here. So it's really important for me to be in service, like as the wine director, working with the team, seeing what's going on, being across all the different restaurants. So yeah, every week is different.
Yeah.
But that's why awesome. I've stayed in this industry as long as I have, right? I served tables like from university, like, and onwards. I traveled the world and I worked in this industry. It was the way to do it, but like, I loved it. I looked at other things, you know, and I kept coming back here, and then finding wine was great because it was like a way to stay in an industry I loved, but be really proud about what I do and have that like focused kind of skill set. But every day is different, right? And you're constantly like having different interactions. You're meeting new people, like you're building relationships such as we have through the industry, right? You meet people, they develop regulars. It's the best part of the job.
And also mentally stimulating. It's like almost every day, every week is a different puzzle to put together. Before we end this, when I was doing my research, one thing I didn't know, you climbed to the base camp of Mount Everest?
I did.
What, when, how how was that?
It was physically challenging.
Yeah, that would be.
So that was, when was that? 2009. I did a whole stint of kind of traveling for like 7 years on and off, trying to figure out what the heck I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But I went with a couple of friends to India. So we had a 2-month trip planned, and we were doing India, and then we wanted to do Nepal, Tibet, and then go over to Beijing, to China. And at that time there was a lot of political unrest sort of between Tibet and China, and we couldn't get the visa. So we couldn't get a visa for China. It's also just kind of impossible to get to Tibet any day. We had this portion of our trip that like wasn't going to happen. Like, we're sitting in the embassy in Kathmandu and they're like, yeah, you got to go home to Toronto. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to fly back to Toronto to get the visa to come back here to go to China. So it wasn't going to happen. So then we had this extra time. So when we went up to Nepal, we kind of looked at it. So it was unplanned. Like, it was an unplanned thing that
unplanned
happened.
Trip to Everest.
Unplanned trip to Mount Everest. Yeah, so we were in Kathmandu, and they were like, okay, what are we going to do? So they had the two different treks you could do, like Annapurna, the circuit, and then there was Everest Base Camp, and we were like, started looking in it, and we're just sort of like, okay, like, yeah, let's do it. So, and surprisingly affordable at the time, right? Mm-hmm. If you want a summit, different. Like today, that's probably $100K to do.
Which, by the way, it should be. If someone said, Matt, we can get you to the top of Mount Everest, it's $89.95. I'm like, I'm going to die.
Yeah, you will
die. It better be thousands of dollars to get me up to the top of that.
Yeah, that's where like ambition will kill you. Too much ambition might kill you.
Yeah.
But it was great. It ended up being an 11-day trip, like round trip that we did. We had a guide. We had a Sherpa who came with us. We stayed in the little tea houses. Like, by the time you got up to about 4,000 meter in elevation, zero vegetation. So, you know, you're living off a lot of like ramen and hard boiled eggs and peanut butter. And the friend that I was traveling with, I remember, cause you're carrying your stuff. Right. And I remember like maybe buying some chocolate bars and candy. And he's just like, what are you doing? He's like, you got to be as light as possible. And I was like, I'm doing it. Like, I'm going to take these like 6 chocolate bars with me. I don't care. Like, you know, and the littlest thing, like it does add to the weight or whatever. And it was so funny because we're like sitting up there and I start eating it and he's just looking at me and I'm like, nope, nope, should have carried it. But it was the big thing is like the altitude sickness, like the climatization. So, you know, you the first day you'll kind of go and then you'll stay for 2 nights at like 1 camp and then you'll kind of do a little trip the next day where maybe you'll go up like 300-400 meters in elevation and then you kind of come back to acclimatize. And it's funny because I was definitely of the two of us doing it, like the out of shape human of the two of us. And he got really sick and I did it. Like, you get to a certain point where like you just have a headache all day.
Yeah.
For sure, right? But like he physically had to go on Diamox, which was the drug to help you like acclimate. But it was incredible. Like, cool. I look at it and I know at the time I probably was like full of regret and like full of pain and just like, oh my God, like, why am I torturing myself? What is this torture? But when I look back, like, it's probably of like all the stuff I did, like that's up there in the top three, like most memorable experiences.
By the way, if that wasn't in the top three, good for you. If you have like three other ones better. You
know? No, like it was just, I look at it and I was like, and I keep thinking, I'm like, oh, like I should go do it again. And I'm sure I would be in the process of doing it, be like, why am I doing this? This is so hard. Oh my God. And you're not like, you're not with ice picks and you're not like climbing, like you're hiking, but it's just,
it's intense.
It's a lot.
To a lesser extent, I did Machu Picchu. We did the full climb.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, we did the full climb. And yes, even though you got to travel light, I still brought a bottle of wine that we had when we were at the top. Yeah, it wasn't the best of wines because there wasn't a lot of selection, but still had to bring something.
I'll end with this note. Like, this is how you know. Like, and this is my theory that the Irish will just take over the world one day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we go up, right? And that would, like, there was no, like, you didn't drink, right? Like, when you were doing that trick, like, but it's funny because it was 8 days up, 3 days down. Like, you just barrel down because just as you're coming down, you're just getting more energy. So we would, like, skip stops. Like, we just barrel down. So you get to the little village, Lukla, which is like the start off camp. And there's an Irish bar.
What?
There was an Irish bar. Now, granted, this Irish bar was probably like the size of my kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And it had, like, it had a pool table in it, and it had a couple cans of Guinness and a bottle of Jameson, and that was literally the only thing that made this an Irish bar, I think, right? But it was the Irish bar. But, like, how good that first beer tasted when you got, like, back to, you know, the land of the living. Like, that's really the only reason to do sport, I think, because drink tastes so good after.
That's awesome. Where do they go? Blue Bovine, website's address again, just, where should people go to check it out? Seven days a week and lunch as well. Damn, that's busy. Again, where do they go? I just want to make sure they get some love.
Yeah, absolutely. So www.bluebovine.com, I believe, is the website. We also are on Instagram, same, like @bluebovine. So you can stay on top of what's going on through our social media, right at the corner of Front and Bay. So access coming in those doors from the street, you'll find it. And, like, great hours of operation.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we're open 3 p.m. Saturday, Sunday onward. Happy hour every day. Great to come check out. You know, we're downtown, so close to all the venues for, like, sports and theater and concert. So we do a great, like, prefix menu so we can give people that full experience but make it a little bit more expedited as well. And even late night. Like, you're just looking for a late night place downtown because that doesn't exist. Like, it doesn't exist.
It gets quiet.
Right? And we have DJs and stuff like that. So, like, we're kind of offering a little bit of everything.
Nice.
Which is great.
Next time I come, I won't get lost. I got lost for the media party. I did. I actually asked different security guards underground where it was, and they were all just staring at me.
I get lost in Union, so, like, that's fair. Like,
main level.
Yeah.
If you take anything away from this interview, main level.
Go to the main level, and you will find it when you're on the main level. It's much easier.
Jules, this has been fantastic. Again, congratulations. You know, I've been following you since you were pouring me cool wines at the Oxley ages ago. I love seeing your success. I love seeing what you're doing. And I remember when I sat at Don Alfonso, I'm like, oh, Jules is here. Oh, good. The night literally just got a little bit better. So awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks so much. And you got to come on. It can't be 5.5 years between appearances on the pod.
Oh, my God.
That's crazy. Thanks, Jules.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.